Welcome to the Scuttlebutt Radio Program with your hosts, Tom Claxton and Cal Walters. Radio for veterans by veterans. To get on the line, call 343-0106 now. A show for veterans by veterans.
Welcome to the Scuttlebutt Network Radio Program, the voice of the veterans for the veterans, transmitting live on 106.5 FM and firing shots, the shots heard around the world at scuttlebuttnetwork.com. You're on board with Cal Walters and Tom Claxton, both veterans of the United States Marine Corps, and we're glad that you've joined us to discuss the issues facing our nation's most neglected asset, the United States military veteran. And we've got an outstanding show coming up for you. But first, we want to thank some of the sponsors that help make the show possible.
We certainly do. We'd like to thank the battleship USS Alabama Memorial Park, Alabama Pipe and Supply, the Charlie Wilson Agency, the law firm of Gardberg and Kimberly, Daphne's Hottest Place for Chow, the waterfront restaurant at No. 1 Yacht Club Drive, the Medicare lady, Ms. Keisha Chambers, and Serenity Funeral Home and Gardens.
And, of course, we want to thank all our sponsors and you, our great listeners. We could not do this without your support. So please let them know that you heard it on the Scuttlebutt. And SBN is all about giving our veterans a voice on the issues that are important to them. So join in the discussion on our Facebook page for more information on the topics of the day. Later on the show, we'll be joined by author James Scott. He's no stranger to SBN. He was on with us a few years ago discussing his book, The War Below, which is an excellent read, by the way, which chronicled the fate of the sister subs to our very own USS Drum, which is on display alongside the Alabama here on Mobile Bay. He has a new book coming out called Empire of Ashes, which covers the late stages of World War II and the move to employ the atomic bomb to end the war. So it should be a very insightful discussion. But first, it's always a pleasure to be joined on SBN by Mr. Phil Quigley. Phil, welcome back to SBN, and thank you for your service.
Oh, you're welcome, and I sure appreciate it. And I had to set my phone down for a minute, because what a better way to come back in with the national anthem.
Ooh, don't you know it, big guy.
Yes,
Phil, pleasure to have you on board tonight. You've got your fingers in a lot of pies lately.
Yes, sir.
And I think one of the biggest pie we need to talk about tonight is the August the 7th the Purple Heart event that you're staging over in Daphne.
We sure are, and I appreciate this, Tom. It's at the Daphne Civic Center on August 7th, and it'll be from 5 to 7. And what it is, it's one of the biggest in the country, I found out. August 7th is Purple Heart Day, and we're doing a huge Purple Heart salute for 60 to 70 Purple Heart recipients, and it's going to be a great night, Tom.
That's awesome, man. It's just unbelievable. If anybody deserves it, we have to recognize and support our Purple Heart recipients, because these are our veterans that have been in combat and shed their blood on foreign soil. So we need to continue to recognize that and recognize these guys for what they've done for our country.
Oh, well said. And we have two great speakers. One of our speakers is the longest tenured and Patriot of the Year tenured chancellors in the country, and that's Chancellor Jack Hawkins, Dr. Jack Hawkins.
What an awesome gentleman.
Like you two, once a Marine, always a Marine.
Yes.
He was a
he's a Marine.
Yep. Yep, two-time Purple Heart recipient in Vietnam. And a second one, speaker, is Andrew Delgadio, who just got back 2 weeks ago from their national convention or conference for the Purple Heart, military or the Purple Heart. He was the state commander and now is the vice commander of the U.S., national vice commander.
Well, the gentleman is very deserving, and he's certainly capable of handling it. You know, he's some kind of dean or something with the some college here, I think, over in the Panhandle.
He is at West Florida. And let me say this, and I forgot to mention, another Marine.
Woo! Hey, what can I say, Phil? You know, you Army brats. I mean, you know, I know how y'all are.
Well, I do have a couple cousins that are Marines, so there you go.
Yep.
But anyway, it's going to be a great event. There's so many other things that are taking place besides the ceremony, too. What's going to be pretty cool, there's going to be all kinds of displays and things taking place, World War One, World War Two. The family of Gary Cooper, General Gary Cooper, is going to be there. And matter of fact, the board I sit on as Vice President of Marketing of the Mobile Bay Veterans Commission, Steve Carey, former Air Force pilot, the president, received that award this year, the General Cooper Award.
Woo! Man, that's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. You're Vice President of the Veterans Commission.
And the council, too. Now, like you said, I need some more things, Tom.
I know you need something to do. I mean, South Alabama Veterans Council, you know, we meet once a month over at Post 88.
Yep.
And I know our dear gentleman there, Pat, has retired and stepped back, stepped down.
Yep.
And passed the torch to you.
Yes, and with great honor, from an Army to an Army, from an Army Ranger to an Army Ranger. And you know, something else I want to get out there that we think is very important. You know, we spoke, Steve and I and some of us, because the council is part of it too, hosting. And it's been this year we decided the commission and the council need to get together and host events together. But one thing that Steve has pointed out when we speak to each one of the city councils over in the Baldwin County area, because, you know, we're wanting to be not only Mobile Bay, but we are the South Alabama Veterans Council and Mobile Bay Commission. So that's why we're doing this at Daphne. But we're getting youth involved. We want them to understand what veterans like y'all mean and us and but most of all, these Purple Heart recipients, and we have the JRTC from Daphne, which also Spanish Fort is a part of it. They come over to Daphne High School for the Air Force JRTC. They will be the color guard, and we all know Joe Bushell,
right?
At the
awesome
Alabama Memorial Cemetery. Yeah, he's the Scout Master, Troop Master for 87 in Daphne, and his guys will be doing the flag folding. But even better, what's going to be cool, and Colonel Barrow is going to be in charge of it, because we know that Colonel Barrow was over the JROTC in Mobile County, plus at South Alabama with the ROTC at one time. He's going to be in charge of all. We've got all kinds of cadets, ROTC cadets coming in, and we're going to have them and some of the Boy Scouts escort each one of the recipients
awesome.
Out, which Major General Mike Summerall and Admiral Davis, Kent Davis, who's this year's Patriot of the Year, they will be hosting the recipient's room, the VIP room, and bringing them out.
Right. Right now, that the VIP room has to do with the Purple Heart recipients only.
Yes.
And that's not open to the public.
No, that's where we want to get them all together, you know, where they can kind of meet and greet and tell stories. But we are going to have, when they come out, we're going to have some of the Boy Scouts and some of the JROTC get to talk with them right outside of the VIP room, get to know them. The hour before the ceremony starts, like I said, come, because we're going to have it has a large stage. You've been in the Daphne Civic Center. We're going to have the Baldwin County Youth Orchestra playing. We got all kinds of videos. Toby Keith, as you know, who supported, God bless, rest his soul, who was kind of, I call him kind of like the country singer of Bob Hope, because he would go on those USOs and support the veterans. Yeah, we got some of his videos playing. And Lee Greenwood's going to, with the song, you know, we all love that he sings, Proud to be an American. We're going to end it with him, but it's just so much that's going to take place.
It is awesome. You know, and we've got some special guests there. I know we've got a 100-year-old Navy a veteran that's coming in.
It was from Baton Rouge.
Yep, and we got another 100-year-old from the Mobile area that was at Okinawa on that attack. And then we've got a World War II Marine that's close to 100 years old. It was also at Chosen Reservoir, so. Yep. A lot of distinguished guests, a lot of outstanding veterans, and we appreciate you being on with us tonight, buddy.
No, we appreciate it. And, Tom, just to remember, you said it right. You know, one of the greatest generations, they're not going to be here much longer.
Right, right. We're losing.
But this is open to the public August 7th, next Friday night, Daphne Civic Center, 5 to 7. We want everyone there. Bring your family. Bring youth. We want everybody there to honor these great recipients.
Thank you, Phil. Appreciate what you're doing,
Thank
brother.
Thank you. I appreciate you. I appreciate you, too, also. Thank you, guys.
Have a good one.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
And always, you can visit Scuttlebutt Network for more information. And on the other side of the break, author James Scott, when we return on the Scuttlebutt.
On their chest, these are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret.
Hit a lick against what's wrong, or say a word for what's right, even though you get walloped for saying that word. Now, I may sound like a Bible beater yelling up a revival at a river crossing camp meeting, but that don't change the truth none. There's right and there's wrong. You gotta do one or the other. You do the one and you're living. You do the other and you may be walking around, but you're dead as a beaver hat.
It's Scuttlebutt Radio with your hosts, Tom Claxton and Cal Walters. Radio for veterans by veterans. To get on the line, call 343-0106 now.
And welcome back to the Scuttlebutt Network radio program, the voice of the veterans for the veterans, transmitting live on 106.5 FM and firing the shots heard around the world at scuttlebuttnetwork.com. And if you like to listen on demand, you can catch our regularly aired shows on the FM Talk 106.5 app via their podcast. And Tom's tirade is up on castbox.fm if you want to get your blood pressure going. And it is a privilege to be joined on SBN by author James Scott, whose newest book, Empire of Ashes, Truman, Hirohito, and the Descent into Total War, is just about to roll out. You can get it in pre-order now. But James, welcome back to SBN.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me back this evening. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's an outstanding to have you here with us. So, Empire of Ashes, give us a little overview of the book.
Absolutely. So the book, as you noted, comes out next week, so we got a little opportunity to talk about it in advance. But the book looks at the last 125 days of the Pacific War. It begins the day that FDR dies on April 12, 1945, and it runs until Hirohito announces to the public in Japan on August 15, 1945, that Japan's going to surrender. And that 125 days is one of the most pivotal moments in American history, really world history. It is the death of a president. It's the Battle of Okinawa, the bloodiest fight of the Pacific War. It's the confirmation that the atomic bomb works and the Manhattan Project is going to actually help play a role in the end of the war. And, of course, it is the atomic missions themselves. All this, of course, set against the backdrop of the fire raids that have begun in March of 1945 and are continuing against Japan cities. And, of course, on the flip side of that, you have Japan, you know, a country that has largely been sort of its empire reduced back to just the home islands, its military sort of fighting this last-ditch effort on Okinawa, preparing the civilians for a fight against the Americans during an invasion, and, of course, Hirohito, desperate to try to figure out a way out of the war before it develops into any kind of worse catastrophe than it already is. So it's a really it's a very pivotal period of history, and I really wanted to kind of jump in and dig in tight on what that just those few months were like. You know, put readers in the Oval Office, put readers in the palace in Japan, put readers, you know, in the Enola Gay, in Boxcar, on Tinian, and sort of show these things as they unfolded.
Well, it is a fantastic read. I appreciate the copy, and I've poured through it. I think I emailed you, it really is riveting. But this book is the third installment of a trilogy about the war in the air in the Pacific, which included one book on the Doolittle Raid, and then another, as you mentioned, the firebombing of Tokyo by Curtis LeMay. So how did you develop the concept for the books? Did you always envision a trilogy, or did that just sort of evolve?
It kind of evolved. You know, it really did. It's funny, you know, I wrote my book on the Doolittle Raid a decade ago, which is just this amazing story. It's one of the best stories of World War II. And, you know, and as I was working on that book, you know, I started tinkering around with the fire raids and sort of thinking, wow, that's kind of a fascinating period as well. And of course, you know, coming back and revisiting that, it's not, you know, after the Doolittle Raid, the Army Air Forces don't come back to Japan until 900 days later when they start the B-29 missions. And so it really was a natural pickup to sort of begin in October 1944 with the when the B-29s first really arrive out on Saipan and sort of build up. And so I kind of dove into that. And, you know, Hiroshima always kind of overshadows the conventional campaign against Japan cities, which really begins in earnest with the March 1945 fire raid against Tokyo. And people don't realize, you know, we talk about Dresden and whatnot, but Tokyo was far, you know, far greater of a raid than anything like Dresden. I mean, Dresden's about 25,000 people killed. Tokyo's over 100,000. 16 square miles of the Japanese capital are burned out. And it's really just the beginning of really this incredible air campaign that's going to run for the last part of the war. That's going to see the decimation of 64 Japanese cities, 170 square miles of their urban areas burned out. And most people don't realize that even took place. You know, they kind of go from Okinawa and Iwo Jima straight into the atomic bombs. And, of course, the fire raids are what sort of precede and sort of set up the atomic missions. And so what had happened is, as I was working on that book, on the fire raid, I'd gone down, spent some time in Hiroshima, I'd interviewed some survivors, I'd, you know, gone to the archives there, pulled out a lot of accounts that had never been seen in the United States, and I layered a lot of that stuff into my book on Tokyo. And my editor, very wisely, when he read the first draft of the book on Tokyo, said, James, you know, this stuff's interesting, but this isn't a book about Hiroshima, this is a book about Tokyo, that's another book. And he was very right about that. And so what I did is I pulled all that material out, and when we finished editing the book on the fire raids, my editor goes, what are you going to do next? I said, well, we've got all this other great material. I want to dig deep into what happened, you know, in August 6th and August 9th. So I went back to Japan, did more interviews, did more archival work, went to Nagasaki, and really began to sort of flesh out that final, you know, sort of the zenith of total war, when America really takes it from fire raids into atomic warfare. What was the decision-making process like? You know, what was the impact in Japan? And really kind of dig in deep on sort of that pivotal moment in it all.
Well, and I think it's interesting that you mentioned the correlation between the firebombing there in Tokyo, started in March of that year, and of course continued. And you put in the book that you had some of the Japanese civilians, even though Tokyo was just a burned out shell, that they moved back into Tokyo. Yeah. Because they figured there was nothing else left for the U.S. to bomb in Tokyo.
Exactly. And, you know, that's what people don't realize. I mean, like, the fire raids that America did against Japan were so, I mean, huge and consequential for what happened in Japan. I mean, you have, like I said, 170 square miles. I mean, 56 of those miles are just in Tokyo. I mean, we burned Tokyo. We hit it first in March of 1945, but we went back and hit it five more times. So over a half dozen raids, we burned 56 square miles. Well, to put that in perspective, Manhattan Island is only 21 square miles. So we've literally burned out the equivalent of almost three New Yorks. And what happens then is as word gets around Japan that the cities are burning, and of course Japanese cities were designed to be burned, it's crazy as that sounds, I mean, they were all made out of wooden paper with insane density. But as these cities were burning, you see this huge exodus from urban areas by the Japanese public. Almost 10 million people are going to sort of flee Japan's cities. But what happens is when people go out into the rural areas, there's not enough food, and it creates this huge societal strife as well in these small towns and villages. So a lot of people end up staying in the bigger cities. You end up with about 300,000 people in Tokyo alone, and they are literally living in the ruins of a burned-out city. And I'll say it's hard for us today to kind of imagine it, because when you see things on TV about Tokyo, it's all these stealing glass high-rises or whatever. But you look at the photos from then, and it's completely burned out. I mean, you can see for miles. And you had people literally living in these ashes. And what they did is people literally lived in like bank vaults, some of the few things that didn't melt or didn't burn. And so they lived in bank vaults, or they scavenged wood and built, you know, small shelters and lean-tos. And so you ended up with hundreds of thousands of people living in those ruins. And of course, yeah, there's no running water, there's no bathrooms. I mean, you could imagine what an awful environment it was. In fact, I interviewed one survivor in Tokyo, and he said to me, we essentially lived like stray dogs, is how the people lived. And
right, because all the stray dogs had been eaten.
No, totally. Yeah, you couldn't get an animal to save your life there. I mean, Japan, I mean, people forget that. I mean, Japan was so battered at that point that, like, the average daily caloric intake was about 1,600 for people. So, I mean, the zoo animals had been devoured. The pets had been eaten. Many of them have, stray animals. And so, but, I mean, it really was just, and of course, the Japanese government had no plan for how are we going to protect our people in this kind of situation. I mean, they basically just, after the fire raids, they told people, they're like, here's a blanket and some hardtack and a train ticket. Good luck. I mean, they just had no governmental infrastructure in place to help the public there. People were just on their own.
Right. And I think that runs counter to some of the perceptions that Americans and really the world had, that, you know, the Japanese at that point, they were fanatically standing behind the emperor. They were prepared to fight in the streets with broomsticks and things like that. But they were very demoralized. Totally. We only got about 30 seconds before the break, but we can kind of carry that thought over.
Totally. No. I mean, the average Japanese person was spending 5 hours every day just trying to figure out where their next meal was coming from. I mean, the idea that they were loyal to the emperor and the government, just all of that was just simply not the case. I mean, they were trying to survive from one day to the next. And we can pick that up on the flip side of that.
Sounds great. Well, again, we are speaking with author James Scott with The Empire of Ashes, and we'll chat more with him on the other side of the break when we return to The Scuttlebutt.
Radio with your hosts, Tom Claxton and Cal Walters. Radio for veterans by veterans. To get on the line, call 343-0106 now.
And welcome back, and thank you for joining us today on the Scuttlebutt Network Radio program, a voice of the veterans for the veterans, transmitting live on 106.5 FM and firing the shots heard around the world at scuttlebuttnetwork.com. Along with Tom Claxton, I'm Cal Walters, and we're glad that you've joined us to discuss the issues facing our veterans today.
And you're going to have to do those.
Okay. And we do want to thank the folks that helped make this show possible. The Battleship USS Alabama Memorial Park, Alabama Pipe and Supply, our sea lawyer Colin Kimmerly, and all the folks at the law firm of Gardberg and Kimmerly, Miss Keisha Chambers, the Medicare lady, Daphne's Hottest Eatery at the coolest location of a waterfront restaurant at 1 Yacht Club Drive, the Charlie Wilson Insurance Agency, and Serenity Funeral Home and Gardens. And again, we have the privilege of speaking today with the author of Empire of Ashes, Truman Hirohito and the Descent into Total War, Mr. James Scott. So James, prior to the break, we had started to talk a little bit about what might have been a misconception by many, that the Japanese people were in great spirits. They were entirely dedicated to defending the homeland versus the reality that you talk about, where they were just struggling to survive.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the best sort of descriptions I came across was the diary of one of the diplomats from the Philippines who was living in Tokyo during this really pivotal period. And his diary is just absolutely a fantastic window. And he basically says that the Japanese public is just out there with its head bowed, struggling to figure out how to survive while this tidal wave of war is about to wash over them. And I really think that's probably the best way to kind of caricaturize it, in that you've got all the decision-making taking place by just a handful of people. You know, Japan is run by a sort of an interwar council, just six individuals. And they're the ones making all the decisions about how long we're going to fight the war, what it's going to look like, et cetera. While out in the cities, you know, people are struggling with the bombings, they're struggling with the lack of food, raging black market. There's no medicine. Japan has to import everything. And it's not just the fire raids, but it's America's really well executed submarine blockade that sort of cut Japan off from its imports. So, I mean, life for the average person in Japan is miserable. And yet, because Japan has spent so much time in the 1920s and 1930s sort of eliminating a lot of the rights of the public, you know, going after the media, shutting down newspapers, going after academics and trade unions. Really, you see what this consolidation of power in the hands of the military, and that the guardrails that might have protected the rights of the individuals are really pretty much gone. That there's nobody's going to speak out. You know, nobody's going to rise up and risk running afoul of the authorities. And so what you essentially have is everybody's on this runaway train and nobody's going to stop it. And it's just headed to calamity. And that's the great tragedy of it in a lot of ways.
Well, one thing I found interesting in your book is that it seemed as though even behind the scenes, once the Americans took Saipan, many of the Japanese leaders believed that the defeat was inevitable at that point. But they still kept that momentum of war with the war council and even with the emperor.
No, exactly. And Saipan really, the fall of Saipan is really a psychological blow to the Japanese. And you've got to remember, this isn't one of their new conquests that they sort of picked up in the outbreak of World War II. I mean, they've had Saipan and they've had the island of Tinian, both of which are, of course, right there, the Marianas, since the end of World War I. And they've cultivated these islands in the image of Japan. So a lot of Japanese people live there. They're farmers. They're growing sugar cane. It's sort of the dominant crop. So Saipan has people throughout the nation of Japan understand Saipan. They recognize its relativity to the main islands, its importance and whatnot. So when Saipan falls, it shatters the illusion, not just for the leaders, but even for the general public. And you see that in the diaries of the individuals. They're like, hey, the war's not going well. We're being lied to. This is propaganda. The fall of Saipan is a significant blow. But what you really have is you've got this sort of divide amongst Japan's leaders. And by that, I mean, it really kind of comes down amongst the different service branches. And that, yes, the Navy has largely been destroyed. And what's left of the Navy is going to be wiped out in the Battle of Leyte Gulf in October of 1944. The Air Force is pretty much gone, and what's left of it is being relegated into kamikazes. But Japan still has a really big undefeated army of about 5 million men under uniform. Under arms. And the Army's argument is, well, we've not been defeated yet. And yes, the Navy has an Air Force, but we're still ready to fight. And for us, that big battle is going to take place on the main island of Japan. And what we have to do is we have to get the Americans here in our backyard, and then we'll slaughter them. And we'll make it so costly for the Americans in sort of their efforts that they'll have no choice but to give up this demand of unconditional surrender. And so, and the army is a very powerful force in Japan. It's the most powerful of the three. And that what you see is that, you know, the army carries a lot of weight, and they're throwing that weight around in Japan at the leadership level. And so you get this country on the wrong track, headed to destruction, and yet you have leaders who are sort of hell-bent on staying that course. And that's effectively what happens. I mean, it's a course of national suicide.
Well, and closer to the end of the book, you describe the push or the divide for those who wanted to continue the war and those that felt like they needed to go ahead and accept the unconditional surrender, which was really, those familiar with the Japanese culture, the concept of saving face is highly regarded. And that unconditional surrender really broke that belief. But you even had people even at that point in their war council. I mean, there was talks of maybe there would be a coup or an assassination or a kidnapping and keeping this thing going.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right. I mean, that's the thing that and even the Americans understood that, like, surrender just wasn't a verb in the Japanese vocabulary. And if you look at the war in the Pacific and you look at the different campaigns, the different islands, nowhere throughout the Pacific do you see organized Japanese surrender. I mean, what you ultimately see on island after island is just the total extermination of Japanese forces. Take Tarawa, for example, which I think is one of the most fascinating battles of the war. You know, 99.7% casualty rates for the Japanese. I mean, we had to kill them all, effectively. Mm-hmm. You see that even on Saipan. I mean, you see civilians jumping off cliffs rather than be captured. Same thing on Tinian. So, I mean, and the Americans understood that, and they knew that unconditional surrender was something that was going to be very difficult for the Japanese to sort of wrap their heads around. And so there was a push, even inside the United States government, that maybe we should soften our demands and not force unconditional surrender. Because wouldn't it be better to just get the Japanese to surrender and end the war versus holding out for what some people argued was verbiage, you know? And so that's kind of one of the big debates that Truman has to deal with there. But the American public had been really adamant after World War One, and, you know, World War Two, of course, grows out of the ashes of World War One, that unconditional surrender was a really important thing and that we needed to go in and we needed to remake these societies. We needed to rip out the roots of Nazism. We needed to undo the laws, the governmental structures that had been put in place. We needed to change the military and just change the culture. And we needed to do it in Germany and in Japan in order to prevent us from having to fight another world war two decades later. And so it becomes a pretty big policy that America is pretty wedded to by the time Truman takes over. And of course, in Japan, as you noted, you know, even despite how bad things were, and the emperor is beginning to push, starting in June of 1945 to surrender, you know, he's got these huge obstacles to overcome as well, which is getting the army on board with that. And then what ultimately happens is even after Hirohito sort of forces the issue and forces Japan to surrender, junior officers who are going to be fanatical about it are going to launch, unfortunately, an unsuccessful coup, but a coup nonetheless, in which they're going to seize the imperial palace, try and capture Hirohito, capture the recording he's made announcing Japan's surrender, and try and prevent Japan from surrendering. So literally the surrender of Japan is something that is just, it's on a knife's edge all the way up until noon on August 15th when it is finally broadcast to the nation. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things about it is that people don't realize. They think, oh, after the atomic bombs were dropped, the war was over. No. I mean, the atomic bombs are dropped. It is a catalyst to start that process, but all the way up until Hirohito goes on the airwaves, it could go either way. And
right.
That's
there,
how
there was so much,
it really was.
So much uncertainty there, as
exactly.
You described in the book. Now, we're up against a break. James, can we keep you for one more segment?
Absolutely.
Outstanding. We're talking with author James Scott, Empire of Ashes, and we'll chat more with him on the other side of the break when we return to the Scuttlebutt.
Climbing high into the sun. Here they come, zooming to meet our thunder. Adam boys, give her the gun.
Boss, updated winds are 200 at 12. We own the airfield and airspace. You are clear for takeoff. Have a good one. Clear for takeoff.
check your bunker break off. Check your trim set. Check your nozzle steering arm maneuver. Down and turn and go. A low transition. Right turn out. 86. Time and half there on 16. Let's turn them up.
It's Scuttlebutt Radio with your hosts, Tom Claxton and Cal Walters. Radio for veterans by veterans. To get on the line, call 343-0106 now.
And welcome back to the Scuttlebutt Network radio program, a voice of the veterans for the veterans. You're on board with Tom Claxton and Cal Walters, a couple of Marines with just a little bit to say, the First Amendment right to say it and the fighting spirit to keep it. And before we jump back into our conversation with James Scott, I do want to mention this is Fireside Saturday at the Warrior Legacy Ranch. It's going to start this Saturday at 6 p.m. And there is a door prize drawing with a cooler of meat products. That's probably like a college fund these days.
Yes, that's so true.
There you go. But take a look at it. Get out there and join in the fun. But again, we're continuing our conversation with author of Empire of Ashes, Truman Hirohito and the Descent into Total War, Mr. James Scott. James, one of the things that I thought it was a quote that you had. You know, a lot of Americans have the idea is the bombs were dropped to bring the Japanese to surrender without us having to invade. And you have a great line in the book that it's a quote from Truman. It says, in short, saving American lives, not money, was Truman's goal. Is your conclusion, is that really what ultimately drove that decision for Truman?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Truman, and what's often missing is from discussions about this is Truman's own military service. And it doesn't get a lot of coverage, but Truman, it served as an artillery officer during World War One, and he,
correct,
if you
yeah.
look at his letters, as he's heading over to France, you see, you know, he's writing off like, well, you know, I'm excited to go, you know, I'm hoping this war is going to make a man out of me, all this kind of stuff. And then as he gets to France, he sees the horror of the trenches and the war. He sees shells disinterring the remains of men around him. He understands the horror of it. And he actually writes a letter back to his future wife, and he says, look, if I make it through this war alive, I will be happy to come home and walk behind a mule down the fields for the rest of my life. And so he has seen sort of the horror of the war. And of course, when he takes over, the United States is involved in the Battle of Okinawa. And the Battle of Okinawa is unlike anything other in the Pacific War. It's just it's a hellacious fight. And having been to Okinawa, having led tours over there, been to the top of Hacksaw Ridge and Kakazu Ridge, when you actually get to Okinawa and see and realize that the actual battlefield is only about 20 square miles. It's really, really small. And you think that there were hundreds of thousands of casualties here, 150,000 civilians killed, 25,000 combat fatigue cases for the United States alone. You see the horror that was reflected in the media day in and day out in the United States. You understand why editorials were asking, why is this invasion of Japan going to be any better than the horror of Okinawa? The letters that parents were writing to the War Department, you get this real understanding of just how bad things were. And Truman understood that. And he was looking to prevent, as he said, an Okinawa from one end of Japan to the other. And that's what the invasion was going to be like. I mean, Okinawa and Iwo Jima really foreshadowed the horror that awaited American troops on Kyushu and on Honshu. In fact, a July 1945 Pentagon estimate, you know, projected 1.7 to 4 million American casualties and between 5 to 10 million casualties in an invasion for Japan in an invasion. And so everything was pointing toward a pretty horrific fight. And Truman was adamant about trying to find a way to stop that. And for him, I mean, you know, the atomic bomb was really ultimately the ace card, you know, that came along at the right time, at the right moment, to try and help sort of sway the Japanese to surrender.
Well, and it wasn't something, and you bring it out in your book, it was not something that he took lightly from the very first time, or at least in the book, that he's told that we have this weapon.
Yeah.
He says, I have a decision I've got to make.
Exactly. And you know, he finds out, of course, soon after he takes over as president. And, of course, at this point, the bomb doesn't – nobody knows if it actually works. I mean, they think it's going to work, but until it's actually tested at the Trinity, you know, test in July of 1945, nobody's 100% sure this theory is actually going to equate a large explosion. But they're moving forward under the assumption that it will. And, of course, they get that confirmation at Potsdam when Truman is out there in sort of the battered suburbs of Berlin – meeting with Churchill and Stalin in late July 1945, that in fact this weapon works and that this could be a game changer. And because it's important to note that, like, there's a big difference between defeat and surrender. And a lot of people have tried to argue over the years, well, Japan was already defeated and whatnot, so, you know, the bomb was unnecessary. Well, yeah, yes and no. Yeah, I mean, defeat is one thing. Yes, it's the state of your military. It's the state of your economy. But surrender is a political decision. And we were asking the Japanese or demanding that they surrender unconditionally. And that's a whole different ballgame. And so the Americans needed a way to shock the Japanese political establishment into coming to the bargaining table. And the firebombings hadn't done it. I mean, and it was George Marshall was really worried. He said, look, you know, we burned over 16 square miles of Tokyo, killed 100,000 people, and the Japanese didn't surrender. Why is this one bomb going to be any different? So it was a real fear that even after $2 billion, and after creating the atomic cities and spending so much resources on this, that even the atomic bomb might not be enough to bring the Japanese to the table. So there's a lot of uncertainty at that moment.
Certainly was. I'm to share a little personal story. I had the privilege of going to Japan as an exchange student for about 6 months, and lovely people, lovely culture. Had the opportunity to visit Nagasaki and the Peace Park there. And to a person, the Japanese didn't harbor any ill will against the American people because of the bombs. You know, in a lot of instances, you know, it was, hey, we would have used it if we had them. Is that still the sense you got in speaking with some of the survivors?
Yeah, no, and I'd say I've been really fortunate over the years to have gotten to interview and meet a number of survivors, not just the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but even the fire raids. And I will tell you, and like you, I've spent a lot of time in Japan. I was an English school. I was a public school teacher there my first year out of college, all the way back in the 1990s, a long, long time ago. And my experience with the Japanese has always been wonderful. And I count many, many Japanese as friends. And I've found sitting in the living rooms of survivors, everybody to be nothing but gracious. Does that mean that they still harbor some resentment? I mean, I interview people who were orphaned by these attacks, lost their parents, siblings, their entire family. It could very well be the case, but to me, they were nothing but gracious in sharing their stories, sharing their letters, sharing their photographs. And so, like I said, I've been really, really fortunate that I've just had tremendous cooperation. I think more than anything, too, I think a lot of the survivors, they want their story to be shared. They want education to come of the horror of their experience, because only through education can this future calamity be prevented again. And I think that's kind of how a lot of people look at it, which is, I'll sit down with the American historian, I will tell them my story, because the hope is the more people that learn it, the less likely it is to be repeated.
Absolutely. Now, I kind of want to circle back to a topic we started with, and we got about 3 minutes left. But you mentioned the firebombing of Tokyo and the fact that, you know, the number of people killed and just the devastation there had not gotten them to surrender. But while they're developing the bomb, they've got the selection committee trying to decide what's going to be bombed. Can you share a little bit about that story and also how Kyoto, the ancient capital, was spared?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's a great story. I mean, the Americans were effectively running out of targets. And part of that was there was a race against Curtis LeMay and the 21st Bomber Command, who was just sort of working down its own list of cities to destroy through conventional raids. And so the target committee had put together 17 possible targets, which they then cut down to about a half a dozen. And of those half a dozen, of course, Nagasaki and Hiroshima were two of them. And these cities had so far largely been spared much of the kind of destruction that had been visited upon other cities. So what the United States did is they put out an order that said, you know, these cities are off limits for future targeting in order to protect them, because they really wanted to have a city that was kind of untouched in which to demonstrate the power of this weapon. Now, the city that was that Leslie Groves, who I think is one of the least appreciated yet most important figures of World War II, that he really wanted to go after, of course, was Kyoto. And Kyoto is the ancient and cultural heart of Japan. It's got 2,000 temples there. It is sort of, I mean, even today, Kyoto is one of my favorite cities to go and visit. It's just a beautiful city.
Yes. But
Groves really thought that Kyoto would demonstrate, the destruction of Kyoto would demonstrate just the horror of it all and force the Japanese to surrender. But Henry Simpson, who was war secretary, really pushed back on that. And that back and forth between the two of them would literally go on all the way up, almost until the first bomb was dropped. But Simpson was right. He said, you know, we have to spare Kyoto. He said that, and he was looking at through the lens of the post-war, which was, if we destroy Kyoto, we will make the Japanese so hate us that it will never be reconcilable and will drive them into the arms of the Russians. And so we can't do that. And he was right. The post-war relationship that the United States has had with Japan has been far too important and far too successful to have allowed something like that to happen. And so, but you have to remember, Stimson and Groves have two different sets of goals. Groves' goal is to end the war. Stimson's is to end the war and secure the peace. And so that is a very important distinction.
Well, James Scott, we appreciate you joining us. Love the insight. The book is Empire of Ashes. And what's your website where they can go and pre-order it?
Yeah, www.jamesmscott.com. Again, that's www.jamesmscott.com. Please go. I would encourage people to go check it out. If you like it, you know, read it, get it to your library, wherever you want to pick it up. You know, thank you for reading it, and thank you for the support.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for sharing it. And you have an excellent rest of your evening. And that's going to bring us to the close of tonight's edition of The Scuttlebutt. Please keep our warriors in your prayers, especially those in harm's way. God be with them and their families. Remember, hero is not a four-letter word. We'll catch you on the other side.
Hurrah!